Authorities in Mexico have arrested two people they say were involved in a human trafficking operation. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. In addition to the arrests, investigators rescued 24 young women who are from Colombia and Venezuela. This incident underscores how most of us understand human trafficking as an international crime. But as KUT's Joy Diaz reports, authorities in Texas are deepening their understanding of human trafficking as a local crime. Please note this story contains descriptions that are disturbing.
Ask Tony McKinley about anything there is to ask about human trafficking, and she'll answer on the spot. Ask, for instance, who's at risk.
All kids are vulnerable.
Is trafficking the same as kidnapping?
Very rarely is a kid kidnapped.
What are some red flags?
An older boyfriend is a big red flag.
She goes down a mental list. A child coming home with expensive gifts or being treated to things like manicures and pedicures.
Being gone a lot, not being where she's supposed to be, maybe sudden change in friends. Gosh, am I missing any? Tattoos, yeah, the branding.
Tony McKinley is a licensed professional counselor who specializes in treating human trafficking survivors in Texas. Her answers to these questions about a person being groomed for trafficking are matter of fact. But when the questions turn personal, her face changes and her fingers start fidgeting with the edge of her shawl. That's because, as a child, McKinley was trafficked.
Yeah, I've spent a long time in the healing process. It does take a long time.
She was sold for sex for the first time at the age of 5. It happened again when she was 15, and again at 19. As she tells me the story, I fear her emotional scabs may bleed again.
They wouldn't let me out of this apartment that I was in the whole time.
One night, a girl was painfully raped on McKinley's lap. And after that, both girls were transported to a very dark building.
I was really scared.
Her fingers continue fidgeting with her shawl as she remembers that night and a moment when she was left unattended.
You know, at the time, I didn't really have any belief in any type of religion. I believed that there was a God, but I really didn't know much about it. And when I was sitting there in this dark house, I just heard this voice, and I don't know how to describe it, but it said, get out of here right now or you're never going to be seen again.
McKinley pulled the other girl out of the house and forced her to run. They were able to get away, but they didn't go far. They had nowhere to go.
So we just went back.
Thousands of kids in Texas, 79,000 by estimates from a recent University of Texas study, are trafficked and have nowhere to go. Andrea Sparks leads the child sex trafficking team at the governor's office.
When law enforcement comes across these kids, there's often nowhere to put them. And I think our law enforcement in the past, you know, several years has been facing a huge dilemma. And many times they would end up bringing these kids to detention.
Up until now, a jail cell was the safest place cops had for a rescued child. Not anymore. Things are changing, and change started with a new understanding of who these children are.
The way that we looked at these kids for a long time, we looked at them as runaways, as delinquents. We treated them as child prostitutes, and the reality is there's no such thing.
They are children who cannot consent to being raped 12 times a day for months or years on end. Another change is that nonprofits, government entities, and faith-based organizations are starting to build places of refuge for these children. One is in Bastrop County. It's still under construction, but I was able to get a tour. The location for the refuge for domestic minor sex trafficking is not yet public. The place is still $2 million shy of the amount needed for it to open in 2018, but it's shaping up to be something of a small village, complete with a medical clinic.
That's our creative arts building. So that is where the UT Charter School will be
based
out of.
A house of worship.
That building is our chapel. So
a farm.
To this side of us, this will be the equine facility.
And small cottages where survivors will live. Andrea Sparks with the governor's office says places of refuge are also in the works in Houston, Fort Worth, El Paso, and Killeen, but they can't be ready soon enough, and even when they are, they will only fulfill the needs of a few dozen survivors, not the tens of thousands that are in Texas alone.
So we have a long way to go. But I think there is a new focus on trying to prevent this from happening in the first place. You know, we've got to go upstream and try to get at those kids who we see are vulnerable to this.
Kids like Counselor Toni McKinley was. She was eventually rescued when a stranger recognized her photo from the missing persons poster he'd seen at a nearby gas station and called the police.
That's how I got found. I was not far, like literally a couple hundred feet from where I went missing is where I was at.
Exploited children in Texas could be anywhere. That's why McKinley and Sparks encourage everyone to start paying attention. For Fronteras, I'm Joy Diaz.
Turning now to education. Toni Diaz has been leading a fight to get ethnic studies approved in public schools. He began in Arizona protesting the 2010 law, which was eventually overturned, banning ethnic studies. He helped start the Libro Traficante movement, smuggling banned books to Arizona students. Here in Texas, Diaz wrote a Mexican-American Studies textbook for public schools. That book, the Mexican-American Studies Toolkit, was rejected by the Texas State Board of Education in November. The board said it contained historical and grammatical errors. It's the second such book to be rejected. The first one, Mexican-American Heritage, was heavily criticized by scholars as being factually incorrect and for being racist in its depiction of lazy Mexican laborers. I spoke with Toni Diaz, who's an author, activist, and professor at Lone Star College in Houston. He begins by talking about the rejection of his textbook.
The Texas State Board of Education rejected the Mexican-American Studies Toolkit because they keep moving the goalposts. The textbook met all the requirements and exceeded the academic standards that were set forth. But I think really what's at stake is that the Texas State Board of Education has no interest in implementing or adopting Mexican-American Studies. And some of the members said as much, but what I think is more powerful is for the Texas State Board of Education to give its stamp of approval so that all 1,200 Texas school districts are aware that it exists and that Mixed American Studies is okay to teach now. But it all goes back to the same issue, is that the Texas State Board of Education dreams up its own rules, debates its own rules, and votes on its own rules. So really, if they wanted to adopt Mixed American Studies, they could. They just don't want to.
Well, going back to the Arizona ban, which happened a few years ago, and that has not happened in Texas. They're not outright saying, we are not allowing this to be taught in our schools. They're saying, okay, you can teach it, but only as an elective. And I know there are a few public schools, I know a few here in San Antonio, are teaching an elective course in Mexican-American studies. Why do you think there's that obstacle there for that State Board of Education to finally adopt a curriculum? Because I understood some board members, that was what they were saying about the decision to reject this book. They were saying, why do we want to have a textbook for a curriculum that doesn't even yet exist?
And there's a lot of irony in all of this, but it is important to point out that the ban of Mixed American Studies in Arizona was overturned, and the legal opinion said that it was implemented with discriminatory intent, and that it was implemented for political careers to prosper. But at the end of the day, we're not banning it in Texas, but you can't ban what you don't have. So here you have 1,200 school districts with 52% Latino students who are not being catered to. And the culturally relevant courses were implemented in Tucson in Arizona because the Department of Justice demanded that they be implemented. So I hope it's not the case where Texas is not going to implement culturally relevant courses unless they're forced to. I think there's a window here for them to be proactive and to get with the times.
Well, your textbook was the only one that was submitted to the State Board of Education, and you really didn't have a whole lot of time to put something together. I think normally the process is a two-year process in order to introduce a textbook. And most textbooks, if I remember from my grade school days, you know, they were usually 9th or 10th editions. You were coming up with a textbook from scratch that you had to present in less than a year's time instead of the 2 years that's normally given. So granted, that short amount of time to try to get something together, there are more than likely going to be grammatical errors that could easily be corrected by an editor. Why was your book not given any additional time to be refined?
And that's really a great question, because on top of that, not only did we have only about 7 months to create the Mixed American Studies Toolkit, but the Texas Board of Education could come up with other deadlines. They could have extended it. They could have given us more time. This curriculum helps all students. When I teach Mexican American literature, at least 25% of the students are not Latino, but they all gain from these courses, and everybody really gets into it. So it really is a sad state of affairs that the Texas Board of Education doesn't seem to want to give Mexican American Studies a fair shot or to implement it. All they decided was to maybe talk about it next year.
It should be added here that a press release was issued by Democratic State Board of Education board member Marisa Perez Diaz on November 8th, shortly after the board rejected the Mexican American Studies Toolkit. In the release, Perez Diaz laments the short amount of time granted to produce a textbook, and she also expressed disappointment that there was no existing course that could provide a curriculum and standards that would inform publishers on how to create instructional materials. She also says Diaz was not granted equity nor transparency in the process, and she'll continue to push the board to approve a course in Mexican American Studies. Tony Diaz says that even though the Mexican American Studies Toolkit was rejected by the State Board of Education, it can still be taught in schools. But it's going to involve trying to convince the over 1,200 school districts in the state to adopt it.
At the grassroots level, if a high school or a middle school has the interest and the expertise, they can adopt Mexican American Studies, be it the Mexican American Studies Toolkit or other fantastic textbooks. The complication is that not all of the 1,200 school districts have access to that expertise. And then that's when they realize, oh, we don't have a textbook adopted by the Texas State Board of Education. Oh, wait, we don't have TEKS adopted specifically for the way we want to bring Mexican American Studies to our school. So it's easy for the schools it's easy for, but it's very hard for other schools to adopt it.
So what exactly does your textbook cover, the Mexican American Studies Toolkit? So what is in that toolkit?
And I think here's where it gets complicated. So the Mexican American Studies Toolkit is a survey of Mexican American Studies that fits in the lane that the Texas State Board of Education gave us, which was specifically special topics, social studies, Mexican American Studies. You could have Mexican American Studies in literature, in history, and this particular course is only half a credit, which is half a year. So really what you wind up having is a book that's trying to overcome decades of neglect in half a semester. So this particular book begins with the indigenous experience of Mexican Americans in the U.S. and in North America. And I bring that up because that's also a big issue. When does our history actually begin? Traditionally, some of the textbooks started 1836, which is when Texas gained its independence from Mexico, but that leaves out thousands of years of the story. So this particular book begins with looking at our indigenous roots, and then it moves all the way up to modern-day issues, including the ban of ethnic studies in Arizona. The other thing that I'm really proud of the Mexican American Studies Toolkit is that it positions books in such a way that it works with multimedia. So in the textbook, it will refer you to websites and other social media platforms And that's really the challenge of all textbooks right now. How do you present a textbook in such a way which still has an important role in the classroom that's becoming multifaceted right now? We've got to create material that supports this multimedia era, but at the same time, welcoming the teachers that want to use only textbooks, because there's still some teachers that do that. So this is a fun time to be working on this. Although it sounds frustrating, it is exciting because I think we're actually coming up with the materials that will be used in classrooms of the future.
That was Tony Villas, activist, professor, and author of The Mexican-American Studies Toolkit, which was rejected by the Texas State Board of Education in November. Coming up next on Fronteras, the challenges of a family living on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border.
You know, when I see the wall, I feel like it's that one dividing line that keeps us from being a complete family, from keeping us from being normal in the sense that my kids are deprived of their dad.
We'll explore that story next on Fronteras when we come back. I'm Norma Martinez. Welcome back to Fronteras. America's existing wall along the U.S.-Mexico border not only divides the two countries, but also some families who are separated due to deportation. KPBS investigative reporter Jean Guerrero brings us the story of a California mother who travels to Tijuana as often as she can so her children can see their deported father.
Bridget and Eduardo Borges hold hands as they walk on the beach in Tijuana, just a short stroll from the U.S.-Mexico border fence. They watch the waves splash against steel columns that extend into the Pacific Ocean.
Well, there it is, baby.
Mr. and Mrs. Borges live on opposite sides of that fence.
I don't want to look at it too much.
Why? Don't worry.
Mrs. Borges lives in San Diego County with their three children. She's a U.S. citizen. Mr. Borges lives in Tijuana. He's not a U.S. citizen. He left the country in 2004 due to an order of deportation. After a 10-year ban for entering the U.S. illegally, Mr. Borges thought he could try to re-enter legally. But a 1993 police report had described Mr. Borges as a self-admitted Latin king, a gang in Chicago. The family denies the allegation. But the U.S. State Department is using it as grounds to permanently ban Mr. Borges from the country.
As much as we sent so much evidence, I want to say we sent pictures and DVDs and CDs, everything of what he was doing now, it didn't make any kind of dent.
Mrs. Borges says she met her husband in church when he'd started preaching. Mr. Borges has been a pastor for about 20 years.
Amen. Amen.
They came to the beach from church. They're still in their church attire. Mr. Borges in a checkered blue button-up shirt. Mrs. Borges in a flowing green blouse and her hair neatly braided. Mrs. Borges brought their children to see their father, as she does most weekends. 16-year-old Aaron, 5-year-old Hannah, and 2-year-old Benjamin.
Hannah hasn't asked me, why doesn't, you know, Papi go with us? Or what's going on? Or why can't he just come with us? She just accepts it for now because it's normal to her, and it shouldn't be normal.
Mrs. Borges says she would have moved to Mexico when her husband was deported, but she wanted her kids to be educated in the U.S.
Mostly because Aaron is autistic, and he was receiving speech therapy. He was receiving going to special day classes. The other big issue is that Aaron didn't speak Spanish at the time at all. So I said, let's live on the border.
Mrs. Borges places her hands on a section of the fence that has tightly woven steel mesh behind it.
You know, when I see the wall, I feel like it's that one dividing line that keeps us from being a complete family, from keeping us from being normal in the sense that my kids are deprived of their dad. And I'm deprived of him as a husband.
She says she doesn't have an opinion about Trump's plans to rebuild the wall, because her life already revolves around the existing one.
Bingo.
On Sunday afternoon, it's time for Bridget and the kids to go back to San Diego. Aaron plays video games in the back of the van. Hannah and the baby sleep.
Waiting in the border used to average anywhere between an hour to an hour and a half. And now when we go on Sundays,
It takes anywhere from 2 hours to 2.5 hours.
Mr. Borges drives as they wait in line at the San Ysidro port of entry. Eventually, though, when there's only a few cars ahead of them, he has to step out. He kisses everyone goodbye. Mrs. Borges gets into the driver's seat.
Okay, I'm going to move up.
Her husband takes a taxi back to his house in Tijuana.
I have to try to make the marriage work because I'm committed to it and I love him.
That was Jean Guerrero of KPBS reporting. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced the broadcast. Michelle Dubach is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.